Welcome to the More Perfect Union, the podcast that offers real debate without the hate. Hi, I'm Kevin Kelton, a moderate Democrat in Los Angeles, and with me are...
DJ McGuire, a progressive conservative in mourning from Suffolk, Virginia.
And Greg Matuszak, a common sense liberal who's not even sure if he wants to be a superdelegate anymore. From Cincinnati, Ohio.
Oh, you'll always be super for me, Greg.
Thanks.
Whether you're a delegate or not. And Rebecca Kushmider could not be with us tonight. She's on another one of her fabulous summer vacations with her family, and I'm sure she'll talk about that next week. But Rebecca did write a wonderful Pop Goes the Political Culture column on the MorePerfectUnionPodcast.com website this week. Greg, you want to give us a little bit of what she talked about?
Yeah, Rebecca's articles are usually really timely. This week, she's talked about Asia Argento's scandal in the Me Too movement. And oddly enough, I just had a conversation with someone the day before, and we talked about it a little longer than I wanted to. And we talked about it to death almost. And the next day I read Rebecca's column, and I was like, there was an entire fresh perspective that was probably a little truer and better articulated, and I wish I had that article the day before, because I could have won that argument, but I didn't. So I highly recommend reading it. I know there's also some writings about her vacation with her family, and it's a good read. You know, 10 out of 10, it would have been 11, but you really can't dance to it. So, yeah.
So check that out on the MorePerfectUnionPodcast.com. And we're going to start tonight with the topic that all of America is talking about, which is the passing of the legendary Senator John McCain. Now, everybody knows, of course, that he was a great American hero. He was a POW for 5 years. We've all heard that tale. And we also know that the other thing that made him great was that he was not afraid to stand apart from his party and sometimes take a different path. But DJ, you, I think, had a more personal view of John McCain and what his loss means to you.
I did. It's not because I met him or knew him. It is because I certainly supported him probably more than the two of you did, and maybe more than most Americans. I voted for John McCain 3 times. I campaigned for him twice, in 2000 and 2008. I supported him for the nomination both years and for the general election in 2008. And I genuinely believe that we would have been a better country and it would have been a better world if John McCain had been president either in 2000 or in 2008. John McCain is, I fervently believe, the best president that we never had. And his loss will have political repercussions. Those of us who believed that America could be a force for good and that democracy was better than tyranny abroad, we lost a champion over the weekend. Those of us who call ourselves neoconservative, and I still use that term to describe my views on foreign affairs, we lost a champion over the weekend. We lost one of our own. I always like to say there are only 6 of us left who still think the liberation of Iraq was the right thing to do. It's now down to 5. It's down to 5 now. So that personally affects me because this was, you know, it was not just that I admired John McCain the man, John McCain the soldier, John McCain the American. I admired John McCain the politician in a way that maybe most Americans don't anymore. But this will have political repercussions. There are, I still believe, millions of Republicans who still looked to John McCain as the embodiment of their party far more than they looked to Donald Trump as the embodiment of their party. I left the GOP long before they did. I joined the Democrats long before they did. But I'm not going to be the last one, because John McCain is no longer there to remind them of what the Republican Party was, but frankly no longer is. So the next time Donald Trump undermines NATO, or goes after our trading partners and allies, or cozies up to dictators, they're not going to have John McCain to look at and go, oh, he's still a Republican, so it must still be okay, maybe the party can be saved. He's gone, and the closest thing he had to an acolyte, Lindsey Graham, has thoroughly Trumpified himself. You're going to see a further exodus of those people away from the Republican Party. You're going to see more independents, and you're going to see more conservative Democrats. Make way for them, because they are coming.
So, Greg, what were your thoughts on this loss?
You know, I mean, unlike DJ, I actively worked against McCain in 2008. But I
Me
did,
too.
But I believed he probably would have been president if it wasn't for his pick in VP.
So, you know, my take on this, I didn't love John McCain. I'm very sad that he passed.
Sure.
I have only the best of thoughts for his family going forward. And, you know, there were times, there were things about him that I liked. I actually liked McCain-Feingold. I thought it was a good law. I was very sad when the Supreme Court ripped it to shreds. He was a common sense voice on immigration. He voted against the attempt to undo Obamacare. And there's a few other things that he did that I liked. But he wasn't my favorite politician overall. But I did respect him as a politician. But my concern is very pragmatic, which is that seat now will get filled. I believe that the governor of the state, Doug Ducey, will be able to fill it before his election bid in November. And that means that we go from having 50 Republican senators who can vote to 51 Republican senators will have a vote. That's going to be especially important with the Brett Kavanaugh vote to confirm him for the Supreme Court. And it's going to make it that much harder for the resistance against Kavanaugh to be effective. In other words, I think this might guarantee that Kavanaugh is going to become a Supreme Court justice. I'm a little concerned about that. But you guys, before we started, you raised something that I wasn't familiar with, which was the need for a quorum in the United States Senate before any vote could take place. Could you talk a little bit about that and how this affects it?
Yeah, actually, Article 1, Section 5 of this Constitution, because, you know, I've actually read the Constitution, requires that a quorum, 51 senators, be present for the Senate to conduct business. But DJ will tell us why, at this point, we shouldn't worry too much at this point.
Well, it's just, for the most part, when it comes to the Senate business, the only thing that is really going to divide the parties is going to be the Kavanaugh nomination, which is understandable. But the hearings on that are not going to begin until September anyway. And by September, the late Senator McCain will have been buried, and Governor Ducey the fellow with the unfortunate name, will end up appointing his successor. So by the time the Democrats would want to slow anything down by running for the hills and forcing the Republicans not to have a quorum, the 51st senator will be in place. So I don't think this is really something that Democrats will be able to use to slow any business down.
So this week we found out that aside from the stuff that happened early in the week about Michael Cohen flipping or at least pleading guilty to several crimes that implicate President Trump, and Paul Manafort being convicted of several crimes that might motivate him to someday flip against President Trump, we also found out that immunity was given to David Pecker at the National Enquirer. What's it? American Media something? What's the name of his company? And immunity for Alan Weisselberg, who is the CFO of Trump Incorporated. So these are two people who really know a lot about the ins and outs of Donald Trump's business life and his campaign life before he became president, and two people who could do a lot of damage to him if they know things that he doesn't want the world to know. They're going to have to tell it.
Yeah, if they want to keep that immunity deal. So obviously Pecker did something wrong with the payoffs to
Karen McDougal.
Okay. So he's trying to get out of that federal FEC violation, which that could be time, which I think he's rightfully so. And I believe Alan Weisselberg is the same thing. And this is all still in New York.
Right. This is the SDNY. This is not the Mueller investigation.
Exactly.
Which means that these are people that could not be pardoned, although they're not going to be charged with crimes.
Right. But the big question I have is, are we going to ever see Trump's taxes out of this?
There is actually a list of bullet points going around Twitter. I don't know if either of you have seen it. The list of things that the Democrats will investigate if they take over the House. And it's like a dozen and a half things about the Trump administration and the Trump organization, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The corruption is ungodly. For those of us who knew Trump for 30 years, this is not a surprise that Donald Trump is corrupt. I mean, you know, shocked, shocked. But for the rest of the country, it probably will be a shock because they just assume, oh, well, he was a businessman. No, he wasn't a businessman. He was a thoroughly corrupt, mafia-tied, probable money launderer. So this is just another example of that was happening up in the Southern District of New York, or as it's also known, the Sovereign District of New York, because it can basically do whatever the hell it wants.
Okay, let's get specific here, because I think sometimes in the big picture, we lose the details that people need to understand why this story is important. First of all, let me preface this. A lot of Trump supporters this week are saying, even if he did break the law by not reporting a campaign contribution from his company that should have been reported, a lot of people are saying, even if he broke the law, they don't think that rises to high crime or misdemeanor. They think it's kind of one of those things that everybody does in one form or the other. A lot of people talk about the John Edwards case and use that as a comparison. And so, a lot of people are saying this is not an impeachable offense. If this is the best the Democrats got, they got nothing. And I'm going to say to them, they're right. If this was the only thing that the Democrats had on Donald Trump, and it is a crime, by the way, he did break the law. With the facts that we know, and I believe Michael Cohen to be telling the truth, I think most reasonable people do. But I will agree with my conservative friends and my Trump-supporting friends that this in and of itself is not the basis for impeachment. But this is only going to be one article of impeachment. I guarantee you that by the time Robert Mueller is done with his investigation, there will be 4 or 5 or 6 different articles of impeachment that could be drawn up on 5 or 6 different things that Trump did that were either unethical, illegal, or another version of a high crime. So what I'm saying to people is, you're right. Right now, this is not the impeachment fodder that the Democrats need to overturn an election. This is one element, one component of a much larger building that Mueller is building. Wait until it's all in front of you before you pass judgment, because I believe when you see the breadth of what Mueller has found, it will be meaningful.
So there was a poll done by NBC before before Tuesday, I think, then when all broke loose with the Cohen and Manafort deals and guilty pleas and whatnot. Not guilty pleas, but when he was found guilty. And there was two polls, one before and one after, about what they thought of Trump and his administration. Okay. And what they pretty much found was what people thought of Trump and his administration. Nothing changed. If you were a Republican and you thought he was awesome, you still thought he was awesome. And if you were a Democrat and you still thought he was guilty and pretty slimy, you still thought he was slimy. Okay? And vice versa. Nothing changed. This whole thing, all of this, the payments, everything, none of this is changing anybody's opinion, okay? It's just reinforcing what most people already believe. That
okay, but Greg, here's the thing. Everybody keeps talking about his base, the polls, people's minds are in changing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You and I think a lot of people are missing a very important point. Look, if there's a Democratic House, they are going to vote articles of impeachment. He is going to be impeached. Okay. Now let's assume, as I said, that Mueller gives them enough material to paint a broad spectrum of illegalities that this man has participated in, obstruction of justice, some type of conspiracy to collude with the Russians. There's so many possibilities. What I'm saying is, once you present that case in the Senate, public opinion isn't going to be the driving factor. I don't care if 35 or 38% of the country is still behind Donald Trump. people like Lindsey Graham and Orrin Hatch and whoever else is a reasonable thinking senator who respects the law, these guys are going to have to vote. And it's going to be hard for all of them to vote not guilty. So, you know what? Polls, schmoles. What's going to happen is there's going to be a trial. And I'm not saying he's going to be convicted. But I am betting you that if we get to that place, and we're far from there right now, but if by the end of 2019 we're watching a Senate trial, I think you're going to see somewhere between 5 and 10 Republicans vote to convict because they won't be able to look at themselves, their families, or their constituents and explain why they voted to acquit.
Yeah, I'm going to concur in part and dissent in part. Yeah, I know.
Okay, first Mrs. all, Ginsburg, go ahead.
Yeah. Funny. I'm going to go on the progressive side of my progressive conservative self, and actually disagree with Kevin on whether or not we have met the threshold for impeachment. As far as I'm concerned, we have met the threshold for impeachment with the Cohen discussions. What Mr. Cohen is claiming, and what Donald Trump himself confirmed in the interview with Fox and Friends later. Or after the Cohen plea, was that Donald Trump was essentially set up Michael Cohen as a straw donor to his campaign. Straw donation originators go to jail. Dinesh D'Souza went to jail.
Until he got pardoned by Donald Trump.
No, he was out of jail by the time he got pardoned.
Oh, yeah, he was out of jail by then.
The Democratic donors who were the straw donation originators in John Liu's campaign for controller of New York City, went to jail. Straw donors in Hillary Clinton's campaign, the straw donation originators, who she didn't know anything about, went to jail.
Who was the fella in the Clinton administration, an Asian fella?
Yeah, I can't remember his name. Well, he didn't go to jail because he ran away to communist China and nobody's ever seen him since.
But it was the same thing. But anyways, agreeing with you. This is a real crime. I agree with you.
Right.
Go ahead.
But the fact of the matter is Donald Trump has effectively admitted that he originated a straw donation of $130,000 to his own campaign. If he were not president of the United States, he would have already been indicted and he would be looking at jail time. That is all by itself an impeachable offense. I am not saying that Mueller will not find other impeachable offenses. I'm not saying the Southern District of New York won't find other impeachable offenses. I am saying they have found at least one impeachable offense already right here, right now, as Walter Blunt would say for all you Stars watchers out there. So that's the first thing.
Well, we're not in disagreement there, but okay, go
right.
ahead.
The next thing is, and well, we're also not going to disagree about at least a small number of Republicans in the United States Senate who will have to look very, very hard at voting to convict. I'm not looking at it in the same way that perhaps Kevin is, but I come to the same conclusion. I'm looking at the Republicans who are up for re-election in 2020. Susan Collins in Maine, Cory Gardner in Colorado.
Yes.
Those are the two that first come to mind.
Yes.
John Cornyn in Texas. Now, Texas is still obviously considered a Republican state, but
not much
the way
longer.
Beto O'Rourke is campaigning,
yeah,
it may be more a leaning Republican state. You're looking at things like, I think it's John Isaacson in Georgia. Georgia is a state that is not as Republican as it used to be. Joni Ernst is a first-term senator in Iowa running for re-election. Iowa's been hit hard by the trade war.
Pat Roberts, Jim Inhofe, Lamar Alexander, Mike Enzi, Shelley Caputo, Tom Tillis.
They're going to have to listen to their constituents, and their constituents will almost certainly say, Senator Gardner, Senator Collins, yes, we are quite certain that these are impeachable offenses, and you better reflect what we want you to do. One thing we have forgotten in all of this is that there have been three times in history where the House has attempted to impeach the president. Twice the impeachment succeeded and went to the Senate, which acquitted, and the other time Richard Nixon short-circuited the process by resigning. The party that controlled the House in each impeachment process was the party that won the subsequent presidential election. 1868, 1976, 2000. So for Democrats in 2020, and remember, when a year ago, I was always recommending caution, advising caution, saying, hold up, let's wait for the data to come in, let's wait for the information to come in. I am now at the point where I am convinced the Democrats will impeach in 2019 and that the Democrats should impeach in 2019 because we have an impeachable offense already. I agree with Kevin that we'll find more. I think the fact that these impeachable offenses will be discussed will change the dynamic as people recognize the breadth and depth of what's going on. And yes, I think the voters will take that into account in 2020. Here's what we have to remember. At the same current level of economic growth and economic prosperity, Bill Clinton had an approval rating of 57% in the fall of 2000. Donald Trump can't get to 47%. That's because people recognize that he's a schmuck.
I'm not going to disagree with that.
I've said many times, do not compare him to Bill Clinton.
The More Perfect Union, real debate without the hate, now heard on iTunes and Blog Talk Radio.
Let's actually take this back, and I'm going to actually try to segue for Kevin.
Okay.
The fact that Trump himself now wants to outlaw, what does he call it, flipping?
Yeah.
Essentially. I mean, this is full mafia boss mode. I mean, he is literally, you know, I mean, granted, GOP father, GOP father doesn't really roll off the tongue, although it looks great on Facebook and Twitter because I get lots of likes for that. But, you know, you can just call him Don Cheeto for those of us who are fans of the Godfather series. That works really well. So call him the GOP father or Don Cheeto. But honestly, he's basically saying, I mean, I know I'm probably the only one among the three of us who actually thought there was a point in impeaching Bill Clinton.
Yes.
But this is the same nonsense that I heard 20 years ago. Rats are bad. People shouldn't rat. Excuse me. Rats are whistleblowers. That's what they really are. If we're talking about criminal activity, they're whistleblowers. And oh, by the way, why are they called rats? Because rats abandon a sinking ship. Isn't that really the smart thing to do when a ship is sinking?
And by the way, the irony of ironies is that in doing a little research this week, I found out something that I haven't really seen mentioned much in the mainstream media, which is, you know who himself was a flipper in 1986? Drum roll, please. Donald Trump. So this is what I found out this week. Donald Trump used to purchase jewelry at this store that was known for and got caught using this scam where to avoid New York City sales tax, which is kind of high, they would give the person the expensive jewelry. They'd walk out of the store with what they actually bought, but the store would send either an empty box or a box with a little trinket that was worth nothing to an address out of state so that the person could not have to pay sales tax on it because that's where it was delivered. It was a scam that the New York Attorney General caught it, and they prosecuted the two gentlemen who owned the store. Well, the person who was able to avoid conviction by giving testimony in the case was one Donald John Trump.
Right.
Okay. But Donald Trump agreed to turn state's evidence to avoid being prosecuted.
Well, we've talked about the fact that he's like a goldfish. He can only remember things like for like 10 seconds. So,
but why is that on CNN, that fact? Why isn't it on MSNBC? Why isn't it on the CBS Evening News?
Because, you know what? We're tired of distractions. We kind of want, like...
That's not a distraction. Yes. That's pertinent. When the president says flippers, you know, should be illegal, they should point out that he was flipping 20 years before some of these people were out of grade school.
Because news comes at us like a fire hose.
Yeah.
But I want to actually agree with you. That is something important because it shows the utter hypocrisy of Donald Trump. But I'm guessing, you know, that was something that just popped up yesterday, maybe even this morning. And it's probably not even something that they've noticed yet. Hopefully, one of them listens to this podcast. Hint, 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 and they'll mention it on Monday or Tuesday.
Hopefully.
Okay, so let's go to the other side now, because the Democratic Party was in the news in a big way this weekend, and it didn't get a whole ton of coverage, But the DNC apparently voted to change the rules on how they're going to use superdelegates going forward. So, DJ, do you want to give us a little primer on how things changed?
I can give some on it. Apparently, superdelegates will not be allowed to vote on the first ballot, which essentially means that for the first ballot, which is usually the only ballot that matters, it will only be elected delegates that will have the power to nominate a presidential nominee, which I frankly think is good for a whole bunch of reasons. I'll get into that later. They're also looking to allow – they're saying that caucuses must allow for absentee votes and that primaries should try to find a way to be more open and not necessarily so closed. Those are really the three main prongs of the reforms. And frankly, I like them, but that's just me.
Recommendation that primaries no longer be party affiliates only, that they be open to all voters? Is that the recommendation?
That's their recommendation. Now, obviously, that is dependent upon state law.
Right. That's a state issue.
You can't change state law. You know, my state, for example, does not have party registration, which is its way of allowing for open primaries. I don't know about California, but I think Ohio has closed primaries. Greg,
we have open primaries.
Oh, you have open primaries.
Yes. Ohio's kind of awesome that way.
I stand corrected then. So, yeah, it's essentially encouraging Democrats say, look, state Democratic parties, you should find ways to open up your primaries or maybe encourage state law to open up your primaries and such. It essentially tries to minimize the cronyism that the Bernie Sanders supporters accuse numerous state Democratic parties of having. In some cases, I think the Sanders people had a point. In other cases, I think the Sanders people didn't have a point. But I frankly think these reforms really are a good thing. I think they are helpful to the Democratic Party. They show the Democratic Party being more open, being more dynamic and willing to change. And frankly, I mean, I was a Republican for 25 years. We never really used superdelegates when I was in the Republican Party, and it seemed utterly ridiculous. So I'm glad that the Democrats, that my newish party, is acknowledging that superdelegates really are not so super.
All right. I like the concept of superdelegates. I've always liked the concept of superdelegates. I like the fact that people who work hard in the party, you know, and so on and so on. But let me ask you a question. I've worked with Ohio politics for decades. But the question, and because of that, I know a lot about primaries, Ohio primaries in particular. But I'll admit, I don't know anything about caucuses for the most part. So can you guys give me a quick thing on what's the difference between a primary and a caucus? I'll admit my ignorance here.
I'm going to acknowledge my own ignorance in that I've been involved in Republican caucus equivalents, but I've never been involved in Democratic caucus. I think Kevin actually has. So we should defer to him on this one. Kevin?
Yeah. Well, you know, California has a primary system, but, there's also caucuses for some reason, because I know that because I was at one in 2016 in my district. And again, I'm not exactly sure the caucus was to elect delegates who would then become delegates if their candidate won the primary. Okay. or some such thing. But the short answer is I have been to caucuses. To explain the difference, Greg, it's really quite simple. A primary is like a presidential election. People go to the polls, they vote. A caucus means you have to go to a place, usually a school gymnasium or a union hall or something like that, that has been rented out by the party, and you discuss who you're going to vote with, debate who you're going to vote with, and it's all done in small groups. And then those groups, the results of those caucus groups are reported to the state and they tally it all up. I'm not giving an exact explanation, but that's the basic gist of it. In a caucus, you have to go someplace. And the reason this is now pertinent is because one other change that the Democrats made, from what I understand, is that it used to be that just like you can't vote absentee in the Senate, or you can't vote absentee in the House of Representatives, it used to be that you could not vote absentee at a caucus. You had to be physically present. And that actually depressed turnout. Well, it depressed the vote because people weren't turning out to caucuses the way they turn out to general elections. But I understand that part of the new Democratic rules will allow people to participate in caucuses even if they're not there with some kind of an absentee ballot. Is that correct?
Yeah, essentially caucuses now have to accept absentee ballots. And again, I've been at the Republican equivalent of presidential caucuses at the local level. I've been at a state convention. I've been at local county conventions or mass meetings, as they're called. And essentially it's just, you know, a bunch of people get together and you hear various speeches on behalf of various candidates. And then the folks who are in the room decide which candidates they wish to support.
Well, Greg, I want to point out that I actually agree with you. Look, the change has been made, and I guess at this point discussing superdelegates is almost moot. I actually didn't have the big problem with superdelegates. Of course, I was a Hillary Clinton supporter, so I guess it's easy for me. But I think that they threw out the baby with the bathwater here. Here's where I think the Democratic Party went, you know, off the proper path with superdelegates. The idea of superdelegates originally was to take elected officials, senators, governors, congressmen, and give them a vote as kind of a check on what could be a populace that maybe got things, you know, like really crazy. Like maybe, you know, a populace that decided to forego the qualified politicians that were running and, you know, instead vote for a con man who's a businessman who has no political experience. Something crazy like that.
Crazy. Crazy.
Just hypothetically. Hypothetically. If it could ever happen.
Sure.
Where I think they went wrong was they kept expanding the number and it became a little perk of working for the Democratic Party to the point where everyone that worked for the DNC was a superdelegate.
Right.
That's where it went off the rails. What I wanted them to do, and that got to about it, almost 15% of the delegates were de facto superdelegates because of that. It was too great a percentage of the full delegate population. What I think they should have done is take that privilege away from people who volunteer for the DNC. Look, they do good work. They volunteer. It doesn't mean that they should get to be delegates. It should have been limited to senators, congressmen, and ex-high officials and governors. Those should have been the superdelegates. It should have been under 5% of the full delegate population for the Democratic Party. That would have been workable. Okay, they went a different way. They said, we're still going to have all the superdelegates, but they don't get to vote till the second round. That's cool. Until someday when we get to a second round, and then we're going to have the same problem again. Why all of a sudden are these people affecting the outcome when it's going to be different from the populace? So I don't know that they solved anything. I think they just deferred the problem for another few election cycles.
Yeah, I agree. But and the good news is, though, that the DNC is listening to issues from the progressive side. And so we can't be called shenanigans, at least. So, you know, I'm just going to say
think, that. I've spent 25 years in the Republican Party and, you know, maybe a year and a half in the Democratic Party. So I don't know the Democratic Party particularly well, although it is my newish party now. But I will say in terms of the elected officials, in the Republican Party, elected officials followed the primary voters. You know, the primary voters went with a particular nominee, in this case, Donald Trump, and they went, oh, yeah, we have to follow our voters. I really didn't see anything. I haven't really seen from the outside anything where the superdelegates went one way and the primary voters went the other way. The closest thing would probably have been 2008, where Hillary Clinton actually got more votes than Barack Obama, but that was because she participated in two states, Michigan and Florida, that had been penalized by the National Democratic Party, so Obama avoided them. That was probably the one instance where the superdelegates really did put a thumb on the scales, because they essentially said, well, we would essentially, after Iowa, they said, well, we would really prefer Obama to Hillary Clinton, and they had an impact on the caucuses. That's really where superdelegates have an impact. They don't have an impact on the nomination floor of the convention. They have an impact in their states if their states have caucuses. Because in caucuses, it's about party activists who talk to each other, who work with each other, who like each other, and who listen to elected officials from their party. And if elected officials from their party say, hey, we want candidate A, they're more likely to go with candidate A, even if the Democratic voters don't necessarily agree.
Well, it becomes an endorsement. Well, right. And the party could just separate the concept of endorsing from the superdelegate process. I agree with you, DJ. I think that that is one way that they could affect the outcome, and I agree with your analysis of 2008. One other way, and I think that this is what the Sanders people have actually been getting at in a roundabout way for a couple of years, and it's one area where I think they may have had a point, and that is, look, Hillary Clinton had been running for president de facto for a year or two before she announced.
Right.
And she was a senator. She was well-liked. She played the party. And therefore, a lot of people were already on board with her come the summer of 2015. Then Bernie Sanders decides what seemed like in a day to announce his candidacy for the presidency. He actually had to, you know, they actually had to find a lectern to put in front of the Capitol for him to make his announcement at the last minute. Mm-hmm. The problem with Bernie Sanders was he had as much right as anyone else to run for president. We could get into this, should he have run in the Democratic Party? It's a different issue. But he did. He ran for the Democratic nomination. The problem was, you don't just do that on the spur of the moment at what was really almost, you know, the walking up to the starting line of a race without having done any of the prep for it. If Bernie Sanders had done what Hillary Clinton and everyone else who ran for president that year, and everyone else who runs for president every year, if Sanders had done the same thing and started a year before with an exploratory committee, putting out feelers, working his Senate colleagues and people in the House of Representatives to build those relationships and let them know that he was going to run and what kind of a platform he was going to represent, he would have gotten some superdelegates, and you wouldn't have had this perception that out of the gate, Hillary Clinton already had a 400-delegate lead. That, I think, is the reason that so many Sanders people were upset. It's because that perception, you know, by the time they got to Iowa and then the second round, I think, was it March? I forget what it was. I know Iowa was February 2nd. Then maybe it was South Carolina. Then maybe it was Super Tuesday.
Yeah,
but anyways,
they had it. Yeah, they had a draw in Iowa. Sanders won New Hampshire going away because
right next
door.
Right.
And then Clinton won Nevada and South Carolina.
Right. But what would have happened is if Hillary Clinton hadn't built up that superdelegate count, Sanders probably would have been ahead of her in delegates coming out of New Hampshire and Vermont. And then the perception would have been very different. And people think if that perception had been different, he might have been more competitive going the rest of the way, which he wasn't, with the exception of Michigan and Wisconsin.
Yeah, I'm not sure I agree with that, because he lost Nevada and he lost South Carolina. And this is the one thing that, and again, I'm not saying the reforms are bad, I actually like the reforms. But the one thing the Bernie Sanders folks really have not wrapped their heads around and did not solve
is he lost big.
Well, not just that, but in terms of who he lost, it was African Americans and Hispanic American Democrats who delivered the nomination to Hillary Clinton because they felt that Bernie Sanders simply did not understand them, nor did he speak for them. Bernie Sanders in particular never solved that problem. Now, there may be another progressive who does solve that problem. I won't rule that out. But Bernie Sanders himself was incapable of solving that problem. And Bernie Sanders supporters have never really come to terms with that.
That's true. You know, there was, again, we're relitigating 2016, but while we're here, there was this presumption on the part of the Sanders people that if he could defeat Hillary Clinton, even though he had done so poorly with the black vote and the Latino vote, that because those were consistently Democratic demographics, groups that voted Democratic, that they would just naturally support him. There was no evidence for that. And the fact of the matter is, if Bernie Sanders had gotten the nomination, he might have done better than Hillary Clinton did with white urban voters. But he might have done significantly worse with black and with Latino voters, and he might have still lost the presidency because of it. So I know that I'm going to get tons of letters and notes from people saying, oh, Kelton, you just hate Sanders. You're just a Clinton, you know, sycophant, blah, blah, blah. But the reality is you can't just claim, oh, the blacks will come to him or Latinos will come to him. Women will come to him. They didn't. That's why he lost. And you can't just say that you know, I would have gotten them because I would have had the nomination. No, maybe you wouldn't have.
Yeah, I agree with Kevin completely. And while there were those who will simply say that Kevin is a Clindroid,
the fact
of the matter is, I still remain convinced that had Bernie Sanders been the nominee, he would have lost Virginia, he would have lost Colorado, he would have lost Nevada, and that would have been enough to lose the presidency, even if you do win Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, which maybe he could have been better at. But he would have lost those three states.
I agree.
I remain absolutely convinced of that.
I agree. I'm going to pull an audible here, and DJ, I want to ask you something.
Okay.
You're now a Democrat. You have been for about a year and a half. It's because you feel that your party has lost its way and become the party of Trump.
My ex-party, my former party. Go on.
But you're still a conservative, and you still agree with a lot of the traditional positions of the Republican Party. My question to you is this. Can you envision a scenario in 2021 where Trump is no longer president, a Democrat has won? I'm going to just throw out a couple of names. Let's say it's Cory Booker. Let's say it's Joe Biden or Elizabeth Warren. Could you envision yourself going back to the Republican Party at that point?
I will support the Democratic nominee in 2020. I know that. And I know that because, one, I am quite certain that Donald Trump will be renominated in 2020. And two, even if I am wrong and Donald Trump is removed from office and it's President Pence who's nominated in 2020, I will still prefer the Democratic nominee. I am in the position of a lot of folks like Gene Kirkpatrick, Max Kampelman, Elliot Abrams, Richard Perl, folks who probably our listeners have never heard of, and that's okay because I'm a weird geek on this stuff. They were 1970s Democrats who were just, they could not handle Jimmy Carter, and they went to Ronald Reagan in 1980 because Ronald Reagan agreed with them about the nature of the Soviet threat. And I kind of feel myself in the same position, although in reverse. There are a lot of things I disagree with. And let me rephrase that. I disagree with Elizabeth Warren on a whole bunch of domestic things. I probably disagree with Elizabeth Warren on a whole bunch of foreign policy things. But democracy is in danger, both here and abroad. And the Republican Party either doesn't care, or they don't really, a lot of them just really don't like democracy anymore. And whatever policy disagreements I may have with Elizabeth Warren, it doesn't change the fact that President Warren will be far better for democracy, both here and abroad, than President Trump or President Pence will be.
There you have it, everybody. DJ McGuire just endorsed Elizabeth Warren for president.
No, if she's nominated. And if I can say that about Elizabeth Warren, and I know I can, then I am certain that I can also say that about Joseph Biden or Cory Booker, with whom I actually have more agreements on issues than I would have with Elizabeth Warren.
Okay, I want to be fair now. I put DJ on the spot, so Greg, it's only fair that I do the same to you.
Yeah.
Can you envision a scenario where Donald Trump is the Republican nominee in 2020?
Yeah, sure, I can see that.
And the Democrats run a person that you really have large policy and philosophical differences with. Let's assume it was a Democratic version of Donald Trump.
Okay.
But there's an independent running. And that independent is one John Kasich.
Oh.
Could you pull the lever?
Come on.
Could you pull the lever for him?
No. Oh, no, 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 no.
Really?
No. Well, let me think for a second. Okay.
You're asking if Greg would vote for John Kasich?
No, John Kasich did such a number on Ohio. He did such a number on Ohio and then had the gall to turn around and say, gosh, this was great. This was wonderful. This was all me.
Yeah, Kevin, if John Kasich switched parties and actually became the Democratic nominee, we would have to walk with Greg into the voting booth and pick up his hand by ourselves and force his finger to push on John Kasich. No, he said that's what it would take.
He said John Kasich was the independent, which John Kasich would have to be.
I know.
But no.
Look. I'm using hyperbole here.
Okay. So it's a no.
No.
Okay, well, I just want to end on this one thought. DJ just painted a visual picture of us walking Greg into the voting booth and literally moving his hand to punch the Democratic, or in this case, the independent.
No, I assume Kasich was candidates. A Democrat in that scenario. Otherwise, okay. There's no point.
I just want to point out that that's how we got 5 million illegal aliens to vote in California in 2016. So, with that, we want to thank our listeners for listening. Please follow us on Twitter at hashtag MPU Podcast and on Facebook at facebook.com/MorePerfectUnionPodcast and share our link on your Facebook timeline so your friends can discover us as well. If you like debating politics and you'd like to debate between shows, there's a Facebook group that we're all in. It's called Open Fire Politics, and you should join it. Come be part of the debate that's going on in this country. People used to talk about having a national dialogue. Facebook and Twitter are where the national dialogue is happening, folks. If you're not being a part of it, you're missing out on democracy. So come to Open Fire and do your part to move the national dialogue and advance the national dialogue. And with that, guys, so what's going to be the big story for this week in the Russia investigation, in the Mueller investigation? Will there be more indictments before the magic day of Labor Day?
Twitter is already alight with rumors that Don Jr. might be indicted soon.
Oh, you just made my evening.